Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's great to see the project to get a proper peace studies department at Oxford still making progress. It's a long uphill job, and in fact it took the Quakers many years to persuade my own university 50 years ago to set up a department of peace studies. But they did it, and we're still here, so it proves that you can have a lasting presence at peace in the area of peace studies. I was asked by Liz to do a fairly broad talk, a sort of introductory talk, and this is what I'll do. Can I just check that the sound is fine at the back? Everybody can hear me? Great, thanks very much. Where do we start? We're looking really, I mean, what I'm asking for is to sort of paint with a very broad brush, because we have a full day ahead of us with some extremely interesting talks and lectures on the issue of peace, particularly in relation to the changes we need to make, but focused especially on the United Nations. And I suppose many of us here will have had personal experience of the UN. I worked many years ago in Uganda and Kenya when I was still a plant pathologist working on crop research, and had many contacts with UN staff there. And one of the first international conferences I went to was actually at FAO in Rome, where the Food and Agricultural Organization was doing some of the early work trying to assess the actual losses from diseases and pests, particularly to tropical crops. And this is at a time back in the early 1970s when there just wasn't enough data, basic data, to know exactly what the problems were. And I was in the lucky position of being asked to do a survey of a particular crop, particular set of diseases across East Africa. It was a two-year job to set it up, and I probably learned more in those 2 years than any other 2 years in my life. So to that extent, at least, I have a personal regard for the UN work on food and agriculture. Let me look really pretty broadly. What I want to do is to try and suggest, it's only a suggestion, of the major challenges that we face as a world system. Now, obviously, there are specific issues which may cause us a great deal of concern. For example, after what we've been through with COVID-19, the issue of pandemics and the risk of future pandemics. And we see it just at the moment with that sudden breakout of a particular virus on a cruise ship and wondering whether it would spread. Essentially, I think COVID-19 has made us much more aware of the problems that we face in this regard, and how important it is for people to work together. And I think one of the issues that we've found with COVID is, in spite of all the efforts of medics across the world, epidemiologists, all the work done by the World Health Organization, frankly, we were wanting in many areas as to the nature of the response and the speed of the response. And the net result is, if we take some of the more scientific studies, over 20 million people were killed by COVID-19, and probably still continue to be killed because of the long COVID problem. That was a learning lesson, and we have much to learn from that. There are other issues for the future. We still have all the issues of weapons of mass destruction. Biological, I think, in particular, having started originally as a biologist, I've always been very interested in the capacity for gene manipulation and its dangers when it comes to biological weapons. And the fact that the Biological Weapons Toxin Convention, which dates back to 1972, is actually a remarkable convention because it provides for a full ban on the whole area, but has no verification procedures built into it of any substance. And so, in other words, it is there, but to some extent, it just does not follow through. One of the most important things in that regard is to get a much stronger convention. Difficult at the moment, but nevertheless, we certainly have to persist with it. There are other areas as well. You have the issue of basically artificial intelligence and all that goes with it and how little we know. But I'd suggest that over all of these issues, there are three trends which I think we need to watch, which have been long-term and both individually represent very big challenges. But in addition to that, they interact in ways which I think we haven't fully appreciated. What I'd like to do briefly is just to go through these, talk a little bit about the problems and the solutions, and then try and look at the interrelations and how this relates in particular to the work of the UN. I think I've actually got about half an hour for this, which is extremely generous. I'll try and use that time very wisely and quickly so that we do have time for initial comments, if that's okay with you, Liz.
Thank you.
Well, what I'd like to suggest is the three really important issues can be summarized in three words: environment, security, economics. As the issues in each of those which I think counts. Let me start by environment. Now, we all know the problems that we face in the global environment. This goes right back, well, you could go right back to the early 60s. And I would say that one book in particular in the early 60s, Silent Spring, by that fisheries biologist in the United States, and essentially what she was saying really was that really, we're heading for huge problems. And in her case, Rachel Carson was saying that it's a question there of the impact of toxic pesticides on wildlife. But that actually woke people up in a very major way and helped to really instill the kind of feeling for the need for science in this field in the 1960s. I would say another book published at the start of the Stockholm Environment Conference in 1972, which was Limits to Growth, combination of scholars from the MIT, was really very well ahead of its time. It was rather dismissed at the time, but if you check and say what it was saying, it predicted major environmental constraints developing, particularly in the 2010s and 2020s. So to that extent, it's well ahead of its time, even though it was to some extent ridiculed by the older thinking at the time, back in the 1970s. Where we are now, without question, is the key issue, the most immediate issue, even though it's not the only example of environmental limits, is of course climate breakdown. And I use that term climate breakdown rather than climate change, because in a sense to use the term change is frankly outdated. And we face much more serious problems than this in terms of actually possibly irreversible changes in the climate through what we conventionally call tipping points. Now, the point about this has been realized for many years. When I look back on my environmental science lecture notes back in the early 70s, there were already indications there in what I've learned that this is going to be a very big issue for the long-term future. People were saying that then, and we tend to forget that. What I think is significant here is that we're facing a problem in which we can now, as distinct from about 10 years ago, see the way to solutions, but we're a long way from implementing. But the point is, this is a problem which could be utterly disastrous worldwide. We're already seeing the effects in many ways in terms of climate events, which are becoming disasters on a larger scale. And over all of this, the worry that we will hit tipping points, which tend to be irreversible. Now, I won't go into any detail of this. I think it'd be foolish to try and do that. But what I will do is just look at what is happening now in two or three areas. And why is it that, on one hand, people are not taking it sufficiently seriously, but on the other hand, there is much which can and will be done? On the positive side, I think the level of climate modelling is hugely improved on 20 years or so ago. So people working in the field have a much greater degree of confidence, certainty that this is the kind of problem we're going to have, how it will happen, and to some extent even how fast it will happen. That, I think, is a very good change. There is also the recognition that this is not a problem for the future. I would guess that if we were going through this topic just 10 years ago at one of the early Oxfam conferences, we would think, yes, it's serious, but it's to come in the future. That now is different. We can see it happening almost before our eyes, whether it's heat focuses, whether it's more severe climate emergencies. I mean, I'll take the example, but an example which again never really hit the headlines enough, of what happened to the Libyan town of Derna back about what was 7 or 8 years ago. And that was when a huge downpour in the mountains to the south of the city, massive one, sent huge amounts of water heading down a normally fairly dry wadi straight towards the city. And it broke through two dams, overwhelmed them, and sent a wall of water through the city, which was a coastal city. The total number of people killed is frankly not known, but certainly somewhere between 10 and 20,000 people were killed in a matter of minutes. That was a marker of what can happen and will happen on a larger scale. So we're seeing that. But the other side of the coin is, I think people are waking up to it, but even more important than that, we have a much clearer idea of what we can do. That is frankly because we're in an era of potential rapid decarbonisation of economies. One wouldn't even use those words a few years ago, but you can now. I'm probably helped a little bit by one of our sons working in this field. He lectured in environment in basically engineering for sustainable living. And he specializes himself, as it happens, in wind power. But get out very up to date on this. But one of the things that's clear is the astonishing change in the cost of using solar and wind power. It's really out of this world when you see the changes. And that, I think, gives us a very considerable hope. And if you look at what the International Energy Agency is saying now, they are already seeing the change, driven partly by economic necessity, to move away from fossil carbon. And that, I think, is hugely positive, but, and it's a huge but, we are not doing it fast enough. I'll come back to that at the end, but let me just mention the other two areas, and then we can try and put them together to some extent. The second one, obviously, is security. Let me put it this way. Over the last, 25 years, we've seen a number of major conflicts, all of which have been disastrous for the people who were expected to succeed. If you go back to Afghanistan, 20 years it took for the Taliban to come back and have a country now which is even more difficult for women to live in. If you look at Iraq, that was expected, if you remember, to be ended very quickly. In fact, George W. Bush made his mission a country speech only 6 weeks after the start of that war, expecting the Saddam Hussein regime to have gone and everything to be hunky-dory in the future. It was not so. We had 8 years of war, and Iraq still has many problems and still has some vestiges of extreme paramilitaries even operating in its territory now, as indeed still does neighbouring Syria. So there again, you've had a change. It's just not going the way it was expected. You look then at Libya. I'd also point out the war which we tend to forget, and that is the war between the United States, France and Britain and some local states, and ISIS operating in essentially in northern Syria and also northern Iraq. And that was from 2014 to 18. At the best estimate, 60,000 people were killed in that, most but by no means all supporters of ISIS. But eventually that seemed to succeed. But what we've found, particularly with the way in which Libya collapsed into a degree of instability, is the development of this kind of paramilitary movement right across the Sahel area, the Sahel region of Africa. And when you look at it that way, you see that that war too did not deliver what was expected. I'd even go further and say, apart from Afghanistan, Iraq, the second Iraq-Syria period with ISIS, and also Libya, I would suggest that what we're now seeing now is wars which are unwinnable, at least. One of which is Ukraine, and the other, of course, which is Gaza. And we await to see, of course, what happens as far as Iran is concerned. But I think one has to remember in relation to Ukraine, which has been hugely costly in so many different respects, that in one sense, it's one of those conflicts in which neither side can win, but neither side can lose. And what I mean by that simply is that if, for example, Ukraine was to make huge and sudden advances so that Russia was being called right back, then Putin would have the capacity to threaten and possibly even use different sorts of weapons. If, on the other hand, Putin made huge advances from the Russian side, then essentially far too much would be resting on the status of NATO for NATO to allow that to go through to completion. So that is a conflict which has to end at the negotiating table. And it's good that we at least have some news overnight that there's going to be a short ceasefire. And I would point to other wars as well. Certainly Gaza is irreverently disastrous, and although we would have spent a half an hour on this, my personal view is that Israel is probably making itself less secure rather than more secure by its current military policies. It's not an easy thing to say, but I think that's where we stand. So overall, we have this whole issue on the security side of what was expected to work, not actually working. And essentially, we tend to forget that repeatedly. Yet here we are at a time when, the world expenditure on the military is increasing year by year at an astonishing rate. And this is way beyond now, or it's beginning to be beyond, let me be careful, the whole situation that was actually there at the heart of the Cold War. And this is going right across the world. The focus tends to be in Europe, East and West, and also the Middle East. But the United States is planning to increase its military budget by the best part of 50% over the next 2 to 3 years. Now, why is this happening? Why are we so immersed in this? I think this is where we need the really serious studies, and we have to accept one very blunt thing, and that is wars are very good for business. They are very profitable, and we have to appreciate that in looking at any of them. That applies to virtually any country. All the different countries with any kind of armed forces or arms industries of any size have military-industrial complexes, or as one person kindly said a few years ago, military-industrial academic bureaucratic complexes. And essentially they have a life of their own, and they're superior to most other lobbies in terms of the money available to run them, and also the way in which one could always fall back on the issue of support for your country. And I think this is really one of the major problems. And this is where, to some extent, we have an insecurity trap. There is a tendency to want to be super secure, but the more you are secure, the more other countries around you may feel less secure, and you end up going to nowhere. And in my view, one of the tragedies of the last 20, 30 years has been the almost complete collapse of the entire arms control process. Some survive, but only incompletely. But we have no proper arms control system whatsoever for armed drones. And there are many other areas where we've actually gone by the board. We do not have any serious negotiations at the moment on nuclear weapons, except, of course, for the UN idea of a complete ban. And it's highly significant there that so many countries, I think it's now 70 or so, have signed up to this ban, even though it was only put into place in, 2017. So there is progress here and there, but we have a very long way to go. I'll just watch my time. If I ramble on too much, please make a point of intervening. But let me just go on to the final area. We can obviously talk more about this, and this will figure in much of the discussions today. The final one, in some ways, is a very difficult one, economy, because it is so controversial. So this, to some extent, I think, is a personal reflection. But it's worth remembering that if you took the overall data of Western societies measured over about a century, you find that the levels of wealth and poverty, relative to wealth and poverty, actually got better around the middle of that period through until about 1970, and now got worse. And I have to say that we are really, in a sense, in an era of, I suppose what you would call it, runaway wealth. If you look at the way wealth is being concentrated in narrow numbers of hands, it really is quite astonishing. That is not to say the poor are getting poorer. In some cases, yes, but certainly not necessarily at the level that happened in the past. And there certainly have been many improvements. But the reality is, there's now a runaway core. You can measure it in terms of, individuals almost, certainly a few score people, who are quite immensely wealthy. And probably to a great extent that at any time for at least 200 years, maybe the middle period of the Industrial Revolution, who knows. But what we're living in is a period in which you have these huge differences of wealth. And also, I would suggest that the basic model we have now, which is really not so much Keynesianism, but right through now to the neoliberal system, which is much more competitive and meant to be more deregulated, what we're seeing now, I think, is an aid to the improvements in the amount of wealth which individuals can actually get together. When you're now talking about the wealthiest owning, controlling, let me put it that way subtly, controlling something like what? I suppose it would be between $1 and $300 billion individually. And the possibility within a few years of having the concept of a trillionaire, which is almost beyond any kind of human comprehension. But the point about this is it gives people huge power. One small example, back in the last general election in the United States, the presidential election, Elon Musk provided the Trump team, if you like, with the best part of $300 million. Now, $300 million compared with his wealth was some indication of where we stand, because of course his wealth was measured in billions of dollars. And in fact, his wealth is about 1,000 times greater the wealth that he actually donated was about 1/1000th of his overall wealth. That means that essentially, where you have extreme wealth, it is possible to have extreme concentrations of power. And I think we're seeing that more and more. In fact, we've seen it recently on the British political scene as well. What this all means, I think, is when you put together the idea of a world which has environmental limits, it has essentially a system, a culture almost, which is predicated on really being prepared, I suppose, to use what I would call lidism. You keep the lid on problems rather than going to the underlying causes. And on that basis, we tend to rely more heavily on military force and heavy policing rather than look at the underlying issues that are affecting society. And then you have on top of that the whole issue of the changing economic divisions. If you put that together, then we are potentially in a very dangerous place. But as I've said, on the environmental side, we already know how to actually prevent that becoming a worldwide disaster. There's not yet the willpower to do it, the political willpower. And if anything, we've gone onto a back foot a little bit with that, particularly with the likes of Trump in the White House. That doesn't mean it has to be like that. And I think there's real hope that we could move very quickly on this one. But I think it's when you put these factors together that you get the concern about the overall state of the world. For example, if you put together the effect of climate on crop production, on food production more generally, then if climate is making food production more difficult and there tends to be a wide division of wealth and poverty, that means the poorer parts of the world and the peoples of the world suffer disproportionately more. And that, I think, is one of the risks we face. One can even go faster than that. Those of us who have been around a long time will remember there's a rather pop phrase just, what, maybe 4 decades ago, which says that essentially, how best to put it? We're facing a revolution of rising expectations. Yes, we have the rich and the poor, but the economies are doing so well that everybody's getting better, so there's a sense of rising expectations. Now, we're in an era of frustrated expectation. And I think this is a very difficult beast to deal with. I think if you explore it in detail, it explains some of the rapid, unexpected changes on the political side in the United States, in Britain probably now even overnight, and elsewhere in Western Europe. And essentially what it means is this sense that the world is becoming less just for me as an individual. And that applies to very many people. That, to my mind, really has to be changed around very quickly. Let's just finish off, if I may, just with a few words on a more positive side. We live in the potential for a very crowded and divided world. And in fact, I think, the writer Edwin Brooks, about 50 years ago, said that what we had to avoid was, and I quote it precisely, a crowded, glowering planet of massive inequalities, the wealth buttressed by stark force, yet endlessly threatened by desperate men in the global ghettos of the underprivileged. Now, that was a writing 50 years ago. You would probably say desperate people rather than desperate men, rightly, and you would not probably tend to use the term underprivileged. I'm not sure about that last one. I think, in fact, the term privilege and underprivilege are underused in this context. And in fact, they tell you a lot about how the world works and how it is divided. But what he was saying was, we can avoid that and we're going to have to do it. How we do it is difficult to say, but what I would say finally is that the United Nations becomes more and more important in this. Hence, I think it's so important that you've chosen this as the subject for today's conference. Let me just go a little bit more detail that with one or two examples. If you go back to the early 1980s, you had the sudden realization that we had a risk of a huge problem with what was called the ozone layer. And that was basically being delayed, or in fact degraded, by the increasing presence of chlorofluorocarbon additives into the atmosphere, coming from a number of uses, including things like fire extinguishers. But the point was that that was possible to be recognized and action taken. Action was taken remarkably quickly. In fact, you have the Montreal Convention, I think it was 1987, which is only about 5 years after the problems were recognized as being very serious. And part of the reason why that was actually speeded up was actually the work of the United Nations Environment Programme. And they sort of helped the establishment of what you might call an epistemic community of people who knew this was a major problem and had to be acted and would coordinate their thinking and activities in it. And that was one of the reasons why we actually had the convention agreed very quickly. The stinging of the tail, of course, it has taken the best part of 40 years or so to really start having an effect. But we're not in the position of a greater risk from ozone holes. In fact, we're in less of a danger of that, and that is important. And there are other areas, just from my own experience, very early years ago, well, 50 or so years ago, I and a group of people, a friend of mine, were very interested in the whole business of the way in which the world economy did not seem to be working to the best benefit for the poorer people of the world. And there was a very interesting study done. It's by a group called the Hazelmere Group, and it ended up with the Hazelmere Declaration. But that actually was pointing out the way in which the world economy was not working for the poorer. Much of that depended on research done by the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD. And it was hugely active, particularly in the early 70s, around the time of the oil price crisis. Now, the thing about UNCTAD was it had a very bad acronym, UNCTAD, which people used to say, under no circumstances take any decisions. But the point is, what UNCTAD did was set out what was going on pretty bluntly and really tell people what needed to be done. And for a short time, you may remember, there was a plan for a new international economic order in the early 1970s, which really showed the way for the kind of limited but necessary international economic planning, which frankly was thrown out of the window when the neoliberal system came in towards the end of that decade. But the point here is this is the UN again showing the way for what was really happening. I have to say that in the case of UNCTAD, it didn't work, although UNCTAD is still doing extremely interesting work and is part of the group that has been doing this work on what's been happening economically in Gaza. But on the other hand, it sort of prepared the way and showed the dangers we had. And of course, as far as climate change was concerned, the ozone layer problem was a marker of one example of what human activity could do to the entire planet, which we'd not really had before. And that was brought under control to some extent by UN activity. So I suppose all I'm saying here is that when you look at the world problems we have, which are huge, they are dealable with. Sorry about the grammar of that. But the point about this is there is hope for the future. I have to say it personally, and of course this is all personal view, I think the UN is going to be far more significant in the next 20 years than it has been in the past 20 years by necessity. Because sooner or later we have to appreciate, and I think that is starting to happen, that other ways forward have to be found. It's not easy to say that at the present time, particularly the electoral processes and the rest, but that is what must be said. So in conclusion, I think the way I see this day, very sort of tempting of me to say this, but the way I see this day as important is to put it in that context. We have a huge task ahead of us, it is possible, and it's this kind of meeting, and hopefully before too long, the setting up of the Peace Studies Department at Oxford University, that will really give us a chance to make a difference and to be part of a wider process which has to happen. That's the real key. Thank you very much.